Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock right now on this day, World Diabetes Day. In 1908, that is the 14th of November, 1908, Einstein would present his quantum theory of light. 1991, on this day, several years later, Michael Jackson's Black and White would premiere in 27 countries, the Black and White music video, simultaneously in 27 countries at once. In 2002, the Harry Potter Chamber of Secrets film would be released. In 2006, on this day, Casino Royale starring Daniel Craig would be premiering in London. In 2008, on this day, the Eurozone would dip into recession for the first time since its creation in 1999. And yes, they had people to blame. They blamed Germany, they blamed Italy. On the same day, Italy would dip into recession as well, alongside Hong Kong. This would obviously mark the start of the great 2008 recession. In 2010, on this day, Sebastian Vettel would win his first driver's championship by 4 points over arch rival Fernando Alonso. In 2018, on this day, the Brexit plan would be approved by the May cabinet, not the month of May, but the Theresa May cabinet. You tune into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and on the show today, we are taking a look at the latest developments from National Treasury. They're proposing a floor price on alcohol and a revision on alcohol taxes. We're going to speak to National Treasury Acting Tax and Financial Sector Policy Deputy Director General around that, get a sense of what Treasury is thinking here and why proposing this now. Then we've got a conversation with independent analyst Tsepo Kadima around the proposal from Treasury yet again to reconsider the state guarantees that the government provides for independent power producers. To date, it seems there's been about 300 billion rand in guarantees provided. We're going to take a look at Treasury's view on why they no longer think this is a sustainable plan for them. Then we've got a conversation with COP29 specialist from Natural Justice, rather, around the COP29 that's taking place currently in Azerbaijan. The summit or conference has been ongoing for this week and will continue into next week. It's the big climate change conference that we know and love, and we have almost yearly or biannually, I suppose, depending on when. I'll just confirm that. But we're going to get a sense of what's happening at COP29 this year. We're going to get a sense of what is on the agenda and what the priority points are there. Then, because it's Thursday, we're going to wrap things up with an SME. We're going to get a sense of a small business out there doing more than they can to help the communities around them, and get to know a company called Drama Dynamics a little bit better.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
As always, we kick off the show with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunze, to take a look at the market movements throughout the day and see if we can make sense of them. Good evening, Nick. Lovely to speak to you again. Markets, for the most part, for this week, have just had their own thing going on. What's been happening today?
Yeah, evening, Jimmy. Evening to the listeners. Yeah, you're right. It has been a bit of a sort of one step forward, one step back, no real direction ever since the president-elect Mr. Trump came along, and it's caused huge ructions. I mean, it's almost been a tale of two different markets. You have the global markets on the one side in America sort of pushing to all-time highs, and the rest of the world sort of struggling a bit as this dollar has really sort of affected commodity countries, and certainly in South African rand you would have seen those numbers under pressure, and of course also under pressure. But today we managed to squeeze out very small in the green, 4 basis points up, but as we sort of await more numbers coming out.
Nick, we kind of anticipated that a Trump win would be a pro-America win. We'd see the dollar run. Mm. We had baked this into some form of outcome. But looking at how the markets have responded and behaved over the last week, I mean, you touched on big moves, and the gold market, as a prime example, doing the biggest loss, or seemingly the biggest red week that we've had in 4 years, is a very telling sign of the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty. But did we underprice or underestimate the impact of Donald Trump returning to the White House?
So that's a good question, Jimmy. You know, I think markets are fairly discount mechanisms. They sort of they discount the future, and we're who look at the markets every day. We like to think that markets are fairly efficient, but given your intro on gold, you can see they sometimes get it wrong. I think they did get a little bit wrong. You know, there is you can understand before Mr. Trump came along, they were anticipating a much weaker dollar, the Federal Reserve going to cut rates more aggressively, America's borrowing too much money. You know, they played that whole theme into sort of the gold bulls. And of course, what was happening in the Middle East? You know, they haven't solved that problem yet. It seems to be going ratcheting sort of from one level of sort of intensity to another, getting worse actually. So that was also that risk premium that you price in gold. So gold was looking pretty good. But in the space of a week, you know, we've had the dollar on a charge. We've had certainly the likelihood that Mr. Trump thinks he can solve the problems of the Middle East is, you know, in a matter of days. That risk premium has been taken out. So the gold bulls are having a tough, tough old time. But again, Jimmy, I think it's just a lot of uncertainty, and I don't actually think anyone quite knows how it's going to pan out yet before we go into January.
What are you looking forward to other than the end of the year, Nick? I know it's been
a holiday.
it's been that kind of year. It really has. With 50% of the global economy is going into elections this year, the US elections topping things off there. It has really been the kind of year where you just are quite happy to be done with the year. Are we expecting any last-minute volatility? I mean, we've got the Santa rally in December that typically comes up. Mm. We know we've got one more interest rate decision from the US that is set to be in December. Are you expecting any surprises? I suppose you can't really, can you?
Well, given what's happened the last 10 days, I mean, yeah. Look, I would like a positive surprise. I think Mr. Kanyagi in our Reserve Bank, I think they can give us an early Christmas present. I think the surprise for me was they didn't do 50 basis point cut. I think we mentioned it before on the show. We're definitely going to get a 25 basis point cut this month. Let's hope we get a bigger one. So that would be a positive surprise. Any other surprises? Well, let's hope there's surprises to the positive side. You know, let's hope they do solve some issues in the Middle East. And then looking what's happening with oil, getting knocked on the back of, certainly slowdowns in production, all the rest of it, as negative as a low oil price is for some, it's very positive for us in South Africa. You know, we do import a lot of inflation through our energy. So, you know, there's a couple of good things lined up, Jimmy. So let's lean more on the good news story. Let's get some positive surprises before the end of the year.
Nick, looking into next year, before I let you go, I want to get a sense of the China picture. That has not surprised to the upside. In fact, that's been the most disappointing story of the year, with Chinese numbers coming through consistently in a disappointing fashion, with the Chinese stimulus package coming through in underwhelming markets. And that's kind of what's been driving a large part of the sentiment. Was markets were saying, okay, if China's going to get back on track, there is hope. Now there isn't a lot of that left, or there isn't a lot of time left in the year. We could potentially still see it next year. But for now, looking into that kind of space, what happens if we could get another disappointing year from China?
Yeah, so it's actually a very good point, Jim. We should have spoken about it earlier. That's a good point, because China now is South Africa's biggest trading partner. So we've aligned ourselves very much to the East and very much to China. And if we get caught in the crossfires of what is going to be potentially some, no secret that Mr. Trump and his team, they want to come straight after China with potential trade wars and all the rest of it. You know, I don't think that's a good story. It's going to play out quite badly. We don't know quite what the end result will be. Yes, they had come up with some stimulus packages, but China's been struggling to boost the economy. You know, they're trying to hit their official growth target is around about 5%, and that would be it's one of its lowest targets in decades. And they've been unable to even hit that 5% target. So a slowing China is not good for the world, and it's not good for certainly not good for South Africa. So I suspect they're going to have to come up with a more comprehensive stimulus package to try to jumpstart that economy, because otherwise they've still got the potential trade war coming next year. So sure, it's a bit of a negative show this, Jimmy. It's let the year end and stay in bed, maybe.
Well, to be fair, I never thought I'd say this, least of all on public radio, but I, for one, would be happy with a China that comes back and says, we don't care about currency devaluation, we're just going to spend stuff.
Yeah, and let's be honest. I mean, if you actually sit down and do the maths, if the Trump administration want to do it, is what's been mooted, a 60%, you know, tariff increase on all Chinese goods, well, you might as well wipe out half America because that's your Walmart. I mean, 80% of product that comes into the biggest retailer in the world and in America is from China. So that would be literally suicide. So, you know, maybe there's a bit of sanity will prevail nearer the time. But you know, let's see how these two superpowers play it out, I guess.
Well, this is a conversation you and I are definitely going to have at another time, Nick. I find it very interesting that you choose to use the word sanity and Donald Trump in the same sentence, knowing the history that we have there. But we'll have to leave it at that, Nick. Thanks so much for the time. Always lovely catching up with you. Nick Kunz, Portfolio Manager, Sanlam Private Wealth, on what's been happening in the markets, what markets might be thinking, and the kind of year that it's really been.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
So National Treasury has been on quite a bit of a drive. They've put out a couple of statements and press releases and thoughts around what they're thinking about various things. And we're going to look at some of those things now and see if we can make sense of them. We're going to take a look at the latest proposal from Treasury to introduce a floor price on alcohol. This would, of course, affect the minimum selling price that alcohol would be sold at. It would affect the taxes around that and possibly even how excise duties are looked at as we know them. I'm joined on the line by the Acting Tax and Financial Sector Policy Deputy Director General at National Treasury, Chris Axelson, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Chris. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about this latest proposal. What is National Treasury thinking here and why?
Thanks very much. Hi, Jimmy. Hi, everyone. So we're looking at the way we tax alcohol. We haven't reviewed it in a long time. The current system where we try and put a tax based on the average selling price of wine or beer or spirits isn't really fit for purpose anymore. We've been increasing the taxes on that, and we've gone above what the guidelines that we say that we would tax it. So we need to review it and potentially make a change. One of the options we have there is having a minimum unit price. The big problem we have here is the harmful use of alcohol. If, you know, excessive use of alcohol has these very negative social and economic consequences. You know, as a Treasury, we want to increase the price. People might not like that, but we want to increase the price to try and reduce consumption. One of the ways of doing that is having a minimum price, but we've also got other options in terms of reviewing the tax on alcohol for how we should tax wine, how we should tax beer, and other changes that we should make.
Chris, would it not be better to take a look at some other measures? I mean, when we talk about taxes, typically the people that feel the taxes are, yes, the consumers at the end of the day, but and businesses just do some of the passing on of that. Should we not be looking at other measures such as what was done within the tobacco space, putting in place bans on advertising, putting in place systems where you've got a very strict law that says drinking and driving is illegal and this is the penalty? Should we not be looking at deterrence measures outside of just taxes? Well, I suppose that would sit with different departments, not with National Treasury.
Yes, it does. But we work quite closely with other departments on this. We try and take a holistic view of this issue. You've got to use lots of the different policy levers that government has at its disposal to try and deal with this issue. Tax is one of the issues. There's quite a lot of research that's been done worldwide on, you know, which is the best measure, as you say. Like, should you do advertising? Should you look at driving? So a lot of the research comes out and says, actually, it's price. It's just price that has some of the biggest impacts on reductions in consumption, and especially excessive alcohol consumption. So that's what we're trying to focus on. We will work with other departments on other mechanisms as well, but the overall goal is to try and get that consumption down.
So, Chris, take us through how these proposed measures could potentially play out. I know, obviously, at this point, because nothing's been finalized, it's difficult to say this is what's going to be set in stone. Take us through just some of the excise duties implications on the various types of alcohol, because I imagine you see them differently based on the alcohol content of each beverage and those sorts of things.
Yeah, sure. And so this is a discussion document, so we really put it out, and anybody from the public can comment, and we get comment from you know, industry, from the public, from NGOs, and we look for those comments, and then we can have a discussion about it. But we've put forward a few options. The one interesting part of our current system is that wine isn't taxed on an alcohol content basis at all. It's just taxed per liter of wine. So you could have a wine that is only 5-6% and it's taxed the same as another wine at 16%. So, you know, we think that we should move potentially to an alcohol content basis, but also we were thinking we should do something like Canada, where they have different bans for the amount of alcohol you have within that wine. So a much lower level of alcohol volume would have a lower potential tax rate, the middle, higher, and then for much higher level, you know, a higher tax rate on that. So that was for wine, which would be quite a big difference. It's going to be interesting to see what the industry says there. Of course, all exports would not face these taxes, so it's only for local consumption, so it wouldn't hurt the export market. On beer, it's a similar type of thing. We're saying, should we look at the different types of beer? We think it's a great move by the industry to start selling lower alcohol beers, zero beers or 2 or 3% beers where the alcohol is lower. So should those also have a lower value? Beer is taxed based on alcohol content, so you know, the higher value, the higher alcohol content beers do face a higher tax. But we're saying let's make it even more progressive. So for the lower alcohol content, you actually make it even lower, and for the higher, you make it even higher. So those are the types of changes that we're looking at. There's also quite a big difference between the tax on wine and the tax versus beer. So taxes on wine is taxed at quite a lot lower of value, which is similar to all wine-producing countries. We think that differential should be reduced a bit. And for spirits, which is taxed by far the highest, we're not saying that there should be much of a difference. It's just that it should generally increase over time. So we want to also keep discretion for the minister. So this is used as a revenue instrument here and there. So it'll allow, we do want to allow the minister to make increases above inflation if he would like to, but potentially capped at no higher than 10%. But these are all just proposals and we will discuss them and they could change over time.
I sense a very interesting 2025 budget speech. Chris, before I let you go, I want to dip into your brain as the expert at National Treasury around something else that I know for a fact doesn't sit with you and your department, but I'm going to ask you to weigh in on it, and that is the fact that National Treasury has also come out as Treasury to say that the guarantees that are currently being put forward for independent power producers are unsustainable. As of June of this year, I believe there's a contingent liability of around 300 billion rand that had been set aside at the moment by Treasury rather on this. And I kind of wanted to take a look at the thought process here. Obviously, 300 billion rand sitting as a contingent liability on the national balance sheet is a worrying amount. Your thoughts and your comments around the unsustainability of the IPP guarantees?
Sure. No, so this is, it's a very mature market. I mean, we're moving to the seventh bid window with all these renewable energy independent power producer programs. So a lot of these auctions have taken place. A lot of the projects have come to fruition and are moving along. You know, these guarantees are for if Eskom can just never pay, you know, and if they default on those agreements, then Treasury will come in. We've tried to reduce this contingent liability. You don't want these big, big liabilities on your books as a nation. The rating agencies look at that, investors look at that, and if they're too high, they get a bit concerned. So we were just saying for the next bid window, reducing it from 100% guarantee down to an 80% guarantee. And we don't think that will affect the auction too much. So there'll still be some, you know, security there for the project managers, but it will help reduce those contingent liabilities and reduce the risk on our books.
Well, something else that would help reduce those risks on National Treasury's books is fixing Eskom, but I suppose that's a conversation for another day. Thank you so much, Chris, for the time and for the insights. Chris Axelson, Acting Tax and Financial Sector Deputy Director General at National Treasury, on the latest proposal from National Treasury to introduce a floor price on alcohol.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, for something involving both public and private sectors, business and governments are coming together to build South Africa. Just take a listen to how this is happening.
My name is Mzila Mtejane. I'm the CEO of the Minerals Council South Africa. We are participating in the pledge to support and work with government in the rebuilding of South Africa. I think there's huge opportunities that can be achieved. So from a mining industry perspective, what we've been working on is increasing investment in exploration. But as we also see the investment in logistics and electricity, we see some of our big mines continue to expand and grow. And there's a synergy between the small exploratory mines as well as the big mines in terms of how the big miners can invest in exploration and also facilitate that growth. And the growth in the industry is going to have a huge impact on the economy in terms of the secondary and the tertiary economy, so the downstream opportunities are significant. And so combined, we'll see employment creation from both mining as well as many other industries that depend on mining.
To learn more about this impactful commitment to South Africa's future, visit business4sa.org. That's business4sa, as in the word for, .org. And we're going to continue that Treasury conversation with independent analyst Tshepo Radima. He joins me on the line now to take a look at the latest pronouncement or latest comment from National Treasury that they might reconsider those IPP guarantees, those independent power producer guarantees. Dr. Radima, good evening. Lovely to catch up with you again. It's been quite a minute. The statement from National Treasury saying that they've got a contingent liability of around 300 billion rand for these IPPs that are in place at the moment, and they're re-looking at this. Thinking about it off the bat, I mean, I can understand wanting to encourage a particular sector, but surely at some point we knew this was going to be unsustainable.
Well, Remuyaha, good evening to you as well as to the listeners. You are correct. It is unsustainable, but they should have known this from inception that it was unsustainable because of the laws of physics. I mean, if you look at introduction of intermittent energy sources onto a high voltage grid such as the one operated by Eskom is trying to rewrite the laws of physics. And I've always asked the question, why have these persons not been given the Nobel Prize in physics for what they have done? So it's, of course, it had to come to this point. But also what is puzzling is the fact that in South Africa, we have a statute called the State Liability Act, which in turn means that these guarantees were never warranted from inception. Mm. Any entity that does business with the state automatically receives a treasury guarantee. So there's no need for anyone to say, well, in the event of default, therefore we needed this cover, which is now in excess of 300 billion. Because what it then did is that it sequestrated and ring-fenced and effectively sterilized much needed capital that could have gone to the other sectors or productive sectors of the economy. And it should never have been done. So you got 300 billion in the IPP space. You still have in excess of 220 or so billion with Eskom following the 254 billion rand bailout. And then the other state entities such as Transnet and others, they also have got these guarantees. So by and large, the state is still exposed to in excess of 600-700 billion rand. But the question, as I say, why sterilize so much needed capital that can go into the productive sectors of the economy when, in any event, you already have got a statute that serves the purpose? So, but it's not surprising all the same, and I think it is long overdue. But also, it's an elegant way for this government to actually opt out of the renewables energy program without specifically stating that they are opting out. Because going forward, you'll find that most of the funders or the bankers that would have loaned monies to the so-called independent power producers, they did so on two premises. One being that the tariff was at least 6.5 times more than the Eskom's inherent primary energy cost factor, and at the same time with these guarantees. Now, we know that the posture from the government, both from the previous minister, Minister Mandashe, who was responsible for electricity in the main, and now even Dr. Hosien Tsoramokgopa. Both of them, I think they have a posture of saying, well, the industry, that is the so-called renewable industry, has been on the mantra that they are the least cost energy providers. And if that indeed is the case, therefore their cost to Eskom must at least fall in line with what the Eskom's baseload coal-fired fleet is able to produce. And hence we saw in the previous round, which failed to reach financial close, the tariffs were, or the cost rather, because it's not a tariff, it's not regulated by NERSA, that which the so-called independent power producers charge to Eskom. But they came in around 47 cents a kilowatt hour, and Eskom is now sitting from its coal-fired fleet at around 44 cents a kilowatt hour. So there was that attempt to have parity, but in the attempt to do parity, none of those could reach financial close, because the first ones, round one, two, or bid windows one, two, and three, they are averaging 2 rand 48 cents a kilowatt hour. So they were just a gulf apart, and hence we see the unraveling of this program.
It's very interesting thoughts there. I can imagine that potentially a part of this would have been as a result of the fact that there's a historical precedent that's been set by the state entities, in particular SOEs, to not settle their debts, and that's probably what drove this in the first place. But we'll have to come back to that at another time, because we have run out of time. Tata Khadima, I thank you so much for your contributions and your insights. It's always lovely to catch up with you. We always learn something new about legislation, and I'd be interested to see where this conversation ends up with a look at what you can do if you are owed money by the state, and there's a statute in place for that. Tsabo Khadima, independent analyst on the latest reconsideration from National Treasury around the state guarantees for independent power producers.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
The United Nations Climate Change Conference 2024 is currently underway. It is the first week of the two-week conference. For those that don't know what I'm talking about COP29 that's taking place in Baku in Azerbaijan. And that is obviously a very focal point for all of the nations around the world, around things that concern the climate and concern what it is that we're doing to build a more sustainable globe as a population, I suppose. I'm joined on the line by the head of campaigns at Natural Justice, Catherine Robinson, to take a look at the expectations for this year's COP summit conference, rather, and to see if we can make sense of what's going on there. Good evening, Catherine. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with taking a look at what's on the agenda for COP29 this year.
Thanks, Jimmy. And yeah, good evening to your listeners. Well, this is being dubbed the Finance COP. Because finance is going to be one of the key and primary outcomes that parties need to agree on at COP29. So this will be the first time in 15 years that countries will reevaluate the amount and type of finance developing countries receive to pay for climate action. And this is since the 100 billion annual target was set in 2009. And that target was really, really quite flippant. It wasn't science-based. It wasn't needs-based. And that target of 100 billion per year was a target that developed and wealthiest nations, those most responsible for the climate crisis, have consistently failed to meet. So basically the fight now is for a new collective quantified goal that is needs and science-based. And it's really an important opportunity for developed countries to fulfill their legal and moral obligations under the Climate Convention and the Paris Accords. And this is really to provide means of implementation to enable developing countries to phase out fossil fuels, advance a just transition, mitigate climate change, and obviously adapt to the already disproportionate impacts that the Global South faces because of climate change.
Catherine, when we look at some of the critical pain points, there's obviously things that are still up in the air around wars, around potential conflicts of interest that exist in terms of how things are implemented. But the finance one is obviously a big one, where a lot of the countries have said that they're experiencing a lack of financial support from the developed countries in implementing these changes that everybody needs to kind of put top of the list. What are some of the critical pain points that you've been able to identify from just what's been put out there in the conversation?
Well, look, the truth is that the developed nations are consistently reneging on their responsibilities under the convention, right? The Paris Agreement has three fundamental principles, and the principles are historical responsibility, equity, and common but differentiated responsibility. And we know that, you know, global north countries and developed nations are most responsible for the climate crisis, but they don't bear the brunt that the global south faces. They don't bear the level of loss and damage that the global south faces, and they're in a better position to start transitioning, right? And developing countries need money to transition. They need money to mitigate climate change. They need money to adapt, and they need money for the loss and damage that they're consistently facing every time they're slammed with a climate disaster. And already the global south is facing an unprecedented debt crisis. So, you know, earlier this week, the G7 7 plus China rejected the finance text on the table because it, again, was, you know, developed nations reneging on their responsibilities. It was unbalanced. It was inequitable. So the G7 7 plus China, you know, your developing nation bloc, which includes South Africa, is calling for at least $1.3 trillion every year as a climate debt repayment package. So in public finance, in grant-based financing, so that climate vulnerable communities and countries can start addressing climate change. And of course, developed nations, you know, are persistently saying they don't have enough money for climate action, but they've got plenty of money to spend on military aid to fund genocides in Palestine, for instance. So, you know, America has spent billions of US dollars on military aid, on occupation, war, apartheid, and a genocide, but they don't have enough money to pay for what they owe in terms of climate reparations and climate finance to the global south. Military spending across the globe exceeds $2 trillion per year, and G7 7 plus China is asking for a mere $1.3 trillion just to get us started.
Sounds like we're going to get to a point where this conversation becomes very, very awkward. And I suppose that's what happens with conversations that involve money. There's always someone that doesn't want to part with it, someone that else that needs it, and someone else that's caught in between. Do we think that these problems are enough to sort of create a split in how the climate goals are then tackled? I mean, I'm thinking about it from the divide that you've mentioned, the global north versus global south. Are we likely to potentially see a divergence where the global south says, well, if you're not going to assist us, we're not going to do this, and you can pursue this on your own?
It's generally the other way around, Jimmy. Basically, I mean, for instance, Trump has come in again, and he is going to withdraw the United States from the UNFCCC process, which is a disaster for a global problem that requires global cooperation, particularly because of the United States' historical responsibility for the climate crisis. So it's very seldom the global south that pulls out. It's often the global north. We've just seen, although they're not a global north country, we've got Argentina. They've just pulled out because of their right-wing government. They've just pulled out of the climate COP. France basically boycotted because of the Russia-Ukraine war. So what it requires, you know, there's always a divergence between the global north and the global south. There's always a fight because of this fundamental issue that the global north is responsible for the climate crisis, but bear the least impact. And the global south is primarily impacted by the climate, a crisis that they did not cause, essentially. So there's always going to be that divide. There always is a divide during the negotiations. What it requires of the global south is definitely south-south cooperation, south-south solidarity. And particularly on our continent, you know, we need our African group of negotiators to be singing from the same song sheet and really, pushing the global north to be accountable to the the Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Mm. When we look at the accountability side of it, I mean, there has been conversations as well around approaching this from different perspectives. And I want to get your thoughts around this from an impact perspective. There's always these talks around carbon offsetting, and carbon offsetting is essentially not the same as carbon reductions. Reductions are actively reducing the footprint and the carbon emissions. Offsetting is saying we'll continue at these levels. We'll just do something else that offsets what we've done in this part. What kind of approach is needed here? Because if you're the global south, you could just as easily say, well, we also deserve the opportunity to industrialize through fossil fuels the same way the global north industrialized. How do you balance the actual impact requirements that are needed here with everybody's individual agendas and come to a conclusion that actually benefits the outcome of the conference?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is about common but differentiated responsibility. So it recognizes that this is a global problem. We have a common responsibility, but we have differentiated responsibilities depending on whether we are a developed country, a developing country, and our historical emissions, right? So that's the bottom line. When it comes to offsetting, I mean, this is highly problematic because it doesn't lead to actual and real emission reductions, right? So this is about carbon trading, offsetting. It's about ducking and diving from the need to urgently and rapidly cut emissions. We've already seen at this COP that they've already pushed through, bypassing government negotiations, they've already pushed through very problematic rules under Article 6, which is around market mechanisms and carbon markets. And the truth is, carbon markets are a dangerous distraction. What's actually needed, it's not a climate solution. They do not count as carbon emission reductions, and it does not count as climate finance. And they are marred. I mean, carbon markets have been marred by scandal of land and human rights abuses. And unfortunately, what's happened at this COP is it's taken us a step closer to really operationalizing these really risky and false mechanisms to mitigate climate change and to put funding on the table.
It certainly sounds like the teams at COP29 have their work cut out for them. We will keep an eye on the story. It is going into next week as well, and we'll see what the outcomes are. Maybe countries do finally agree to do their fair share based on their fair historical consumption. But until then, we'll have to keep an eye on it. Thanks so much, Catherine, for those insights and for the time. That was Catherine Robinson, who is the head of campaigns at Natural Justice, on the COP29 conference currently taking place in Azerbaijan, and what those outcomes could potentially look like.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. We are 2 weeks away from Black Friday, which means we are 2 weeks away from absolute chaos. Some companies have decided to start doing Black Friday specials a little bit early. We know that this is an ongoing trend. South African companies tend to do a Black Friday month rather than just a Black Friday day. But that being said, it increases the risk that comes with Black Friday and the risk that we all incur as we head into Black Friday and the festive season in general around our finances. We've seen a lot of hackings taking place. We've seen a lot of online scams and things coming out. So we're going to take a look at this. We're going to see how we can better protect ourselves and better be prepared going into this festive season. I'm joined on the line by the head of digital and e-commerce at Standard Bank. That is Dr. Belinda Ratohwa, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Dr. Ratohwa, thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with why these crimes or these things happen so much more at this time of the year. Why is this such a popular time?
Good evening, Jimmy, and the listeners. Thank you for having me. So from an online shopping perspective, we've actually seen consumer behavior shifting much more to online shopping because it's convenient, because then you can get access to a much greater number of retailers than you can physically walk to malls, right? I mean, from a Standard Bank perspective, as an example, in 2023, we saw a 17% growth in online purchasing. So fraudsters are also aware of this, that there's a lot more people online looking for a great deal. And so they really take advantage of this as an opportunity to pose as online retailers and try to get some money off of our shoppers in an unauthorized way.
That's quite interesting. I suppose that does make a lot of sense with the advancements in technologies. Everybody is looking for the most convenient solution, but convenience might not always be the best. But Linda, I want to look at some of the types of scams. We know of some of them. We know of the typical ones where people impersonate organizations or redirect you somewhere and all of those sorts of things. What are some of the unique ones that you guys have come across that consumers should probably be aware of?
I think the phishing one that you just referred to is one that every one of our consumers needs to be aware of, right? Where you have somebody calling you, pretending to be someone from your bank or someone from the tax authorities or even someone from the police. We've even heard reports of that. Be very, very wary of somebody that calls you asking you for your sensitive information, such as your online banking login credentials or an OTP. Do not give out that information. But ones that are more specific to Black Friday that we've seen is phishing. Phishing is where you receive an email communication that has a link. And in Black Friday, we're expecting to see fake emails that are advertising what looks like deals that are really too good to be true. It'll be hard to resist. But I want to warn all listeners, do not click on links, even if the deal looks amazing, especially if that link takes you to a site where you are now required to capture your OTP, your online banking information, and your card information. Hold that really closely. Another scam that we see is online goods scams. And these can happen through websites or even social media. If it's through a website, you might search for certain goods that you're looking for. The website comes up and you see it at a really good price and you go ahead and make a payment, but nothing gets delivered. If it's on social media, what you will typically see is very similar. Really great price being advertised for something that you're looking for. You might even see reviews that are supporting that deal. Be cautious, because not all reviews are valid. Some of them are fake reviews. So don't just go based on reviews. Really do your due diligence to verify who you're dealing with before you make a purchase online. But if I can just summarize, it's phishing and the online goods scams that we really want to warn listeners to be on the lookout for.
Belinda, when we think about the safety measures, I want to look at what people can kind of do to protect themselves. I mean, a golden rule to all the listeners out there, and you know I do this on Warning Wednesdays as often as I can, just don't share your information. Don't click on things you don't understand. There's basic things that you can put in place to avoid these things. But Belinda, to come back to the security side of it, we've also seen an advancement in tech. We've seen an increase in I can now pay from my Apple Pay wallet, or I can now pay from my smartwatch, or I can even pay from a virtual card that's linked to my banking app and all of that. Is this not making us more susceptible to the crimes and the scams? Are these methods really secure? How do we know if a payment method is secure?
Jimmy, I am an avid supporter of technology enhancements because I think technology can bring a level of convenience and time saving that you can't achieve any other way. So if you think about being able to pay by tapping your phone, whether you're using Apple Pay or Samsung Pay or whatever, that means you don't have to carry a bulky wallet. That's convenient. That's great. The technology is built with many layers of security. It is up to listeners to use that security. As an example, we strongly encourage that you use biometrics to secure your phone, right? Because before somebody can make a payment by tapping your phone, they have to be able to get in the phone. Now, it's not cool to not have a password on your phone. I know there's some people who have said, Nale, my partner, we don't hide anything from each other. We don't have passwords. Listen, secure your phone, use biometrics to make sure that if your phone gets lost, it's not so easy for someone to get in. I think if you use those basic measures that are provided, these payment mechanisms are not only convenient, they're also secure and they make life a lot easier.
Belinda, before I let you go, I want to take a look at some of those other tips and those useful tips. In terms of security, is it wise whether now or into the festive period or whenever, to split funds across accounts and all of that. Someone gets into your account and you've now got 13th checks come around in the festive period, and people now have a lot more money and planning around that. And this is not obviously bordering on financial advice, but I mean, for the purposes of safety, is it wise to then say, I'm going to have a little account here. This is my Black Friday account. I'm going to dedicate all of my Black Friday spend to come from that account, so that if something happens from a security point of view, my other funds are safe?
Sure. It sounds like quite a complex way of keeping yourself secure. I think if I was to offer tips on security, I would say start with securing your phone. Make sure that only the phone that you use has access to your online banking profiles. I know we give away phones or sometimes it gets stolen. Do the work. Go log in. Remove any devices that you no longer have with you. Remove them from accessing your online banking profile. And of course, before making payment, verify who you're dealing with. Verify the account details. But listen, Jimmy, I don't think this idea of having a small and a little account is a bad idea from a budgeting perspective, right? Because in as much as Black Friday is going to give us amazing deals, our listeners must remember to spend within your means. Those things that you buy, they'll feel good for a few days, but those repayments are going to be there for longer. So it's important that we shop responsibly and remain within the budget. Maximize value where you can. Of course, I'm going to do that. I know as a Standard Bank client, you know, you get more rewards if you swipe your credit card as an example. But I will make sure that I look at my budget add-on so that I stay within my means.
Maximize value, but most importantly, stay safe out there, folks. It's coming up to be a very busy time of the period. Stay safe and put in place all of the security measures. Rather be paranoid than lose all your money. We'll leave it at that. Dr. Ratoga, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Dr. Belinda Ratoga, who is the head of digital and e-commerce at Standard Bank, joining us to take a look at how to protect yourself this festive season. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best Forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise. And you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It wouldn't be a Thursday if we didn't have an SME of the week to get into. And this week's SME is a very interesting company called Drama Dynamics. I'm joined on the line by the company's founder and director, Melissa Carrera, to take a look at the business and get a better sense of what it is that they do. Good evening, Melissa. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about Drama Dynamics. What is it that you guys do?
Hi, Jimmy. Oh, great. Thank you so much for having me. Basically, we are a drama acting school as well as an acting agency. But I think the biggest portion of what we do is teaching drama classes. And I'll say the majority of our students are children. So we started 15 years ago. Obviously, I started myself. I got up and running, tried to get classes there everywhere. I went to the Barnyard Theatre and I taught classes there. And then I went to many schools in and around Pretoria and tried to get it as an extramural. So I think just to give you a bit of, didn't start immediately. I tried to first start a career in acting. I had a dream. leaving school many, many years ago, I decided to go into acting and I studied it after. And I gave it a good shot after my studies. I think I finished after about 2 years, I think I would say. I thought, no, look, now we need to get something a little bit more permanent, a little bit something more substantial, if you know what I mean. So I went into corporate and I did that for 2 years. And after that, I started, hit the ground running with trying to get Drama Dynamics up and running.
quite an interesting journey. It reminds me a lot of a similar journey I went through. I too went to an acting school, but that's a story for another day. Melissa, tell us about tell us about the training that you do. Tell us about the lessons that you give. I see the website's got a section that has public speaking training. So it goes beyond just acting lessons or acting classes, yes. I'd imagine. Tell us about the full offering.
Okay, so I realized very quickly that right in the beginning that you need to diversify. As a small, tiny little business and trying to get things working, you've got to offer variety. You can't just say, okay, I do acting classes and that's it. So I very quickly added on workshops. So I would come up with like a mime workshop that we could do on a Saturday. And then I would go into doing holiday clubs. And then I also do drama parties and all these kind of things to offer people as much as possible to get it up and going. And eventually I got to a point where I was like, a very big need and a very big thing that we have in South Africa, because a lot of people, you know, English is not necessarily your first language. We're in a world where, you know, effective communication is very, very important. So I saw the need for public speaking, and I actually got I've got a few of my trainers that are exceptional. We teach kids, so the little ones that are still building confidence in public speaking, and then obviously going through all the way to the adults that need a bit more encouragement, especially in the workplace, if they're not necessarily comfortable and confident enough, you know. So the training is done. We've got online options, and we've also got, in-person options at our various venues. So public speaking is one of them. And then we have now opened the agency for those that want to try and go into acting as a career. The other things we offer is like modeling classes. Again, we're not a modeling agency, but we just offer it as something great for our students to build confidence, you know, in a different channel. Then we've got, like I said, the public speaking, and then we offer our classes to individuals and to groups. So it's a little bit for everyone, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, tell me about the parties and the music videos. I imagine a large part of the acting sphere and the acting space is entertainment-led as well. So there's the corporate side of it, there's the business side of it, but there is also the fun and the entertainment side of it.
That really is. It's about having fun, dressing up, playing improv games, having a good laugh as part of a party for a youngster. And then we also came up with princess parties where kids get to experience. We use one of our actresses, one of our teachers dresses up as Rapunzel or Barbie or whatever, and visits a child at their birthday party and entertains them. So that's quite exciting. And then my favorite is our music video parties, where I hire a South African production company to come and fully shoot a music video that the kids lip sync to. And once they lip sync it, we edit it and it makes it look as if it's the actual child's very own music video. So, yeah, that stems from my childhood, standing in front of the mirror with a brush in my hand, singing my favorite song.
That's quite the interesting journey and quite the interesting point that you've arrived at. Melissa, how do people get hold of the business? How do people reach out to you if they're looking for specific services? Is there somewhere where people can follow you online and see what you guys are up to?
Yes, of course. So we have our website, dramadynamics.co.za. And we've got, you can email me, I'm online all the time. It's melissa@dramadynamics.co.za. We are on Facebook and we are on Instagram.
Melissa, what's next for the business? Where do you want to take the business? What kind of offerings are you looking at adding to the business? What's the dream for the business going forward?
You know, I was very inspired. I feel like every year I'm trying to think of new things to add and to diversify. And, you know, we've got a showcase productions that we do for our group kids, and then we've included our individual kids as well, but now for the adults that we've branched into recently as well. And I was quite inspired at the beginning of last year. We were invited by Parliament to address them in the Cape about the importance of public speaking and debate. And wow, it was such an honor, you know, to be able to go to that level and see that we can still be reaching people and saying, look, this is important. No, you don't have to become an actor or an actress. Being confident and being able to address an audience all starts with this kind of training, no matter what you become or who you are in life, right? So I'm very passionate about what I do. I love the impact that we have. So for me, I think I'm going to try and push the idea of franchising. I have a small child now at the moment. I don't think I've got the capacity to go into the different provinces, but I'm very keen to reach out to people all over the country that would be interested in riding with me on.
Well, going to have to leave the conversation there. Thank you so much, Melissa, for the time and for the insights. That's Melissa Carrera of Drama Dynamics joining us for our SME of the week. It's gone 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by the top sport team. From my side, good night.